Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Criminal Law and Procedure Practice Group, was recorded on Friday, June 5th, 2015, during a live Courthouse Steps telephone conference call, held exclusively for Federal Society members.
Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group telephone conference call on the Supreme Court's decision in Elonis v. United States, the Facebook threat case. My name is Will Courtney. I'm the Deputy Director of Practice Groups here at the Federal Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also note that this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today we welcome two experts, John Elwood, who's a partner at Vincent & Elkins, and Kent Scheidegger, Legal Director and General Counsel of the Criminal Justice Legal Foundation. More complete bios of our speakers were provided to you in the notice of today's call, so I'll stop here and preserve more time for the presentations. With that, Mr. Elwood, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much. By way of background, I came to this case not because I've been active in First Amendment law, but through the University of Virginia Clinic that I'm an advisor of. I've argued First Amendment cases on both sides, on behalf of the state and on behalf of potential speakers. Now, this case involved Anthony Douglas Elonis, an amusement park worker from around Allentown, Pennsylvania. A few years back, his wife of, 7 years left him and took their two kids with her. He became very depressed, and as he says, he became more interested in violent music and started posting self-styled rap lyrics inspired by what he was listening to on Facebook, along with a great deal else. He changed his online moniker to Tone Dougie to distinguish himself from what he called his online persona. Interspersed between these various posts were disclaimers that what he was saying, was fictitious. And there were other posts where, conversing with people on Facebook, he said that it was therapeutic. But what he wrote about were, frequently sort of self-styled rap, or you might say sort of free-form poetry, many of the posts it concerned his ex-wife, although she was never mentioned by name, or I should say estranged wife, and spoke, often in kind of violent terms about, what he would like to do with her or like to do to her. Interspersed with that were kind of more conventional efforts at rap, boasting and talking about his prowess and things like that. His wife felt uncomfortable enough or threatened enough that she got a protection from abuse order, which was good for 3 years. But even after that, he continued to post about her, about local cops who he, expressed a gripe about after they had started expressing an interest in his posts. About a kindergarten class, an unspecified kindergarten class, and about the FBI agent who came out and interviewed him. I have my answers to all of the posts, in an effort to try to portray them as benign, but I know that there are other people who would view them differently. But the post about the FBI in particular, I'd urge you to read the last stanza, in which I think he makes fun of people who believe the first couple stanzas, which admittedly sound much more threatening. But in any event, there is the end came for him when he posted about the FBI agent who had interviewed him, and with that, he was picked up and arrested. He was charged with violating 18 U.S.C. 875C, the online threat statute, or rather interstate threat statute. And it says it makes it a federal crime to transmit in interstate commerce, quote, any communication containing any threat to injure the person of another, unquote. At his trial, in accordance with prevailing law in most circuits, it was really 9 out of 10 at the time of this trial. It became 9 out of 11 afterwards. The trial instructed the jury that under the statute, it wasn't necessary for the prosecution to prove that Elonis intended his statements to be threatening. It was enough to prove the defendant, that a reasonable person would have known that other people would have taken his statements to be threats. We argue that was negligence. The government said in their closing statement, it doesn't matter what he thinks. What matters is what a reasonable person would think. The Third Circuit affirmed his, he was convicted, the Third Circuit affirmed his conviction, and it came up to the Supreme Court where the UVA clinic became involved and filed our petition. We actually filed a petition on just the constitutional issue below alone, because that's what was argued below, but the Supreme Court, after relisting the case a couple of times, added the statutory question. I suspect because about a half year beforehand, there was another case involving Franklin Delano Jeffries out of the Sixth Circuit, where they were confronted with the statutory question as well. In any event, the Supreme Court took the case, was argued in December, unfortunately the first Monday after Thanksgiving, and it was decided on Monday, and the court reversed and remanded. The court did not get to the constitutional question, but it addressed only the added statutory question. And what the court held was that this was a negligence standard and that negligence was insufficient. There was a long recitation of how courts will infer mens rea into even silent statutes, the old Morissetti presumption. The court rejected a couple of ideas along the way. It rejected the idea that an idea of mental state was included in the word threat itself, which was an argument that we had made. And the court said it can be a threat even without the intent. And then they rejected the government's expressio unius argument because other provisions of 875C specifically addressed threats made with intent to extort. And the government tried to say, essentially, since this provision doesn't have any intent, no intent is required. And the government the court said that that was overreading expressio unius and that you'd still would have to have some mental state inferred in there unless there was some reason to believe otherwise. They concluded that a reasonable person standard was not enough. They cited cases suggesting that that the courts would be reluctant to infer negligence as a sufficient standard. And they said, well, knowledge or purpose was clearly enough, and we had argued, I mean, both of those are forms of an intent. That is, if you know that the listener is going to view it as a threat and you still say it, that is a form of intent, just as classic intent, which is purpose. Your purpose is to threaten somebody. And they said that that is clearly enough because, you know, both parties agreed on that. But there was this question of recklessness, which really came up for the first time in argument, oral argument. And they said since recklessness was not brief, they would not address it. So it was a fairly narrow opinion, but as the court itself said, it reversed the law in 9 of 11 circuits because the Ninth Circuit, I believe, adopted a purpose standard a while ago as a constitutional matter. And while this case was pending, I believe the Tenth Circuit adopted an intent standard, although I frankly don't remember if it was knowledge or purpose. I think the most interesting of the separate opinions was Justice Alito's. It has a great introduction, which I imagine most of you are familiar with, but he did a play on the statement from Marbury versus Madison about being the duty of the province of the judiciary to say what the law is. And he said, you know, the only thing that this court is saying essentially is what the law is not by saying it's not negligence. Now send it back to the Third Circuit and see what else is going on. He argued that recklessness was enough. He said that once you get past recklessness, there's no further basis for the presumption, which the majority relied on, that a presumption of mens rea, and that no further presumption would be defensible. This is, I think, my first bit of editorializing, but at least it's the most overt editorializing, but I think that that is itself a noteworthy statement because my recollection of the law, which Kent, who is more expert in criminal law, will correct me about if I'm wrong, was that most of the mens rea cases that the court cited speak of you presume, if the statute is silent, you presume knowledge about the thing that makes it criminal. And the thing that makes this criminal is that it's a threat. So you have to have knowledge of the fact that somebody's threatened. To me, that would suggest that it has to be at least a knowledge standard. And most of the other courts, if you take a literal reading of Alito's opinion, it would suggest that recklessness is enough for all the other cases where the court has inferred a mens rea, and most of them it applies a knowledge standard in my recollection. The second thing that I think is noteworthy, and this is even more editorializing, is that Alito devoted Section 3 of his opinion to basically arguing why Alona should lose on remand, which struck me as somewhat noteworthy. It seemed to me that this was kind of a mirror image of Justice Ginsburg on the right, and that Justice Ginsburg will frequently, in her dissent, say how Congress should overrule or express something beyond what should happen within the four walls of the court. And that's kind of what I viewed this as, it was kind of giving a primer to the AUSA on remand, who would have to argue that recklessness was enough and that he didn't do it. The things that struck me as particularly noteworthy were that he argued that Alonis did not preserve a recklessness argument under Rule 30, and he noted the many times, or at least the several times, that the Third Circuit had adopted, or rather said that harmless error applied to instructional error. The last opinion was Justice Thomas, who dissented alone, and I won't bore you with my recitation of that, but he did not agree with a word I said, more or less, or a word I wrote. And he was obviously more persuaded by the government's brief, and he filed sort of a more academic and scholarly version of the government's brief. And with that, I will turn this over to Kent Scheidegger. Kent, take it away.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. As John said, this case did end up being more about the mental element of crimes than it did about the First Amendment. So let me briefly review what the basic law there is. There are two ways of looking at the mental element of crimes. The old version was general intent versus specific intent. So that if you break into somebody's house and you do it on purpose, you don't mistakenly think it's yours, that's the general intent crime of breaking and entering. If you break into someone's house for the specific purpose of stealing something, that's the specific intent crime of burglary. So the newer way of looking at things is the Model Penal Code's four-part breakdown, the highest level being that you have a purpose to achieve a specific result, the second one being that you have the knowledge that a particular result will follow, the third being that you are reckless as to a danger, a known danger of that result, and the fourth being negligence. And the general rule is that negligence is not enough. It takes one of the others. Now, the old way of looking at the threat statute was to say that this particular subsection was a general intent crime, and consistently with some other First Amendment areas, pornography and fighting words, it was sufficient that you knew what you said and that what you said met the standard. And that's basically the approach of Justice Thomas's dissenting opinion, but he was indeed alone on that. Now, under the Model Penal Code approach, I understood the argument for aloneness from trial all the way up through the written briefing to be that they were arguing that purpose was required, that the person had to intend and have the purpose to threaten and scare the recipient. And if he didn't have that subjective purpose, then it didn't matter how clearly it was a threat or how clearly it was that the person would feel threatened. At oral argument, in response to questions, John said it would be either purpose or knowledge. And to me, there's a big difference between purpose and knowledge. On the third possibility that recklessness would do, I did mention that briefly in my friend of the court brief in the case, so it's not quite true that it wasn't mentioned in the briefing at all, but it wasn't mentioned by the parties in their briefing, and that was sufficient for a majority of the court to say that they didn't think it was before them. I find that kind of disappointing because, as Justice Alito said, they've left an awful lot unanswered in this case. They've told the lower court, the standard you apply isn't right, do it over, but we're not going to tell you what the standard is. I think if at the end of the day and after all this litigation happens in the lower courts and it comes back to the Supreme Court that recklessness is sufficient, then there will be no practical difference between what the standard ends up being and what it was under the instruction that that Alonis was convicted under. If you read the statements in this case, for example, there was the PFA that John mentioned, the Protection for Abuse Order. Alonis posts, fold up your PFA and put it in your pocket. Is it thick enough to stop a bullet? I think practically anybody would have to read that to be a threat. And I don't think any amount of disclaimer would make it not a threat. How many times have you heard a person say something and then followed up with, just kidding, and you know perfectly well they're not kidding at all? It happens all the time. So if we get to the point where the requirement is that the statement be made, that the person know what he said, that he knows that it is a threat, or most people would take it to be a threat, and that he is reckless with regard to that risk that it be perceived as a threat, we're pretty much back where we started. So with that, I think we'll go to questions. Will?
Thank you, Kent. I am going to open the floor to questions now. In a moment, you'll hear a prompt that says, the floor mode is on. After that, to request the floor, enter star, then pound. While we wait to see if our audience has any questions, John Elwood, do you have any response that you want to make to Kent Scheidegger?
I have some response, and I also have some stuff that I just plain forgot because I'm senile. I'll start with the thing I've just plain forgot, which is that I join Orrin Kerr in thinking that it might be just as well that the court didn't get to the recklessness issue. I agree that it's very frustrating that we don't have closure on what exactly the mental state is. The court has done this on times in the past, and it's been kind of maddening. I forget what the issue was, but I remember there being some securities law-related issue where the court took something like 3 or 4 cases before they finally got rid of all the alternatives. And so there was kind of uncertainty during all that time, and that is definitely a suboptimal way of doing it. But one thing that I detected was that I thought that there was more kind of confusion at argument than I usually see. And I didn't know if that was because, as I say, it was the Monday after Thanksgiving, or whether it was because mens rea is a very hard issue. And I do think that it might benefit from additional briefing just on the recklessness point, although the court could have ordered that. You know, they order re-argument all the time. They did it once this term in the Johnson case, I think. And here's my kind of more responsive point, which is just that Kent is absolutely right. That the model of penal code admirably, because the old law was so damn confusing, has gone to this four-part breakdown, which is a lot clearer. And I think that there is a lot to that, because I think that part of the reason why the recklessness got traction, even though I only recall Justice Kagan asking about it at argument, but I might be wrong about that. I very well could be, is that there are, I think that Justice Breyer is a big model penal code person, and I think Ginsburg might be as well. I think the problem with applying model penal code thinking to this, though, is that the statute's from 1939 and the model penal code is from 1962. And so it's kind of, it's a little unusual to imply into that old statute a mental state which didn't have nearly the same currency in 1939. And that is the end of my both response and belated opening. Sorry about that.
If I could put in a quick note, the other thing that's very strange is that they took 6 months to come out with such a narrow opinion, which kind of implies maybe that something broader was being debated, but ended up they decided to compromise. So.
Right. I wish that they didn't keep the papers sealed for so long, because I wouldn't be at all surprised if it looked kind of more evenly matched, or if it looked like it was going to be a train wreck of an opinion before the chief came back with this, because Ken is absolutely right that even if Justice Thomas took a long time to write his opinion, which was the longest of the bunch, it still doesn't justify 6 months for a relatively compact set of opinions.
Well, our lines are wide open for questions right now. Again, if you have a question, please press star and the pound key. A couple programming notes while we wait to see if anyone in the audience wants to chime in with a question. We currently do not have any teleforum calls finalized for next week. However, we are very likely to cover any big cases that come down on Monday. We'll do that on Monday and Tuesday of next week. It's likely that on Wednesday we will have our monthly CFPB update call. And on Thursday we will be having a call discussing potential reforms of the Patent Trials and Appeals Board, which has been described as some by a death squad, as a death squad for patents. It looks like we do have one question here, so I'm going to turn the floor over to that audience member.
Yeah, hi, this is Bill Otis, and it's a pleasure to be able to talk with these two very knowledgeable lawyers. John Elwood continues to be both more generous and considerably less senile than I am. John, when you said that the court's opinion does not provide closure to the question of exactly what is retired and required, I think that's extremely generous. My problem is it barely provides an opening as to what is required. If I were still an assistant U.S. attorney, I would have no clue as to what I ought to suggest to the trial judge on remand as a jury instruction for what the jury must find by way of the defendant's mental state in writing a jury instruction. And I guess my second question, which may be more by way of a comment, is this, that I think Kent is correct in saying that under the current state of the law, whatever mysterious concoction it may turn out to be, one need, you can say anything you want, regardless of how menacing, and as long as you put in some boilerplate disclaimer, the defense can get away with claiming, well, you see there, we didn't really mean it, when in fact any person with a grain of sense is going to know that you did mean it, and that the defendant is going to be able to get away with exactly the menacing that he at the minimum knows, if he does not intend, is in what he writes. So with that, let me turn it back to those who know more than I do and see what your reaction is. Thank you very much.
I think as far as what to argue on remand, if I were on the prosecution side, I would say, the court does seem to have gone with the model penal code mens rea structure here, although John is right, it's a little weird to apply that structure to a statute that predates it by 30 years. Nonetheless, that's what they did. And the model penal code says that when a criminal statute does not specify a mens rea, does not specify a mental state, then either the states of purpose, knowledge, or recklessness will suffice. And follow that up with the Supreme Court's recognition in the Garrison versus Louisiana case that in a First Amendment context, recklessness is sufficient for criminal liability in any speech case. So that would be the argument to apply a recklessness standard on remand.
I appreciate being called generous, although that wasn't the kind of generosity I expected. But yes, I am being perhaps a bit generous with the court, because it's true, all they did was cross off negligence. And the one thing, though, is that this is kind of a piece with a lot what the court does, because frequently they hand down opinions where there's no majority opinion, and then people have to sort out exactly what the heck they have to do with where there's a concurring opinion concurring in the judgment that is the important opinion. And I think they've done that in the Confrontation Clause context, because I remember seeing a case recently where I thought that there would be smoke pouring out of my ears if I had to make heads or tails of it. And that's interesting. It'll be interesting to see after I'm dead, I presume, if current trends continue for when the court unseals its papers, what exactly the alternative was here, because it could be that the lack of clarity could have been from, having a train wreck of different opinions versus having a opinion that is clear on one narrow point. But it will be very interesting to see. I would say that as far as mental state goes, I think that it is right that, people may say, just kidding, but I think that will probably work about as well as it would for any of us if somebody said just kidding in a menacing way, because, the jury doesn't have to blind itself to what the other cues are about the person's mental state. And one thing that I think is important to keep in mind is that I think one of the reasons why the court took this case is because it occurred online, where speech increasingly is taking place. And when you speak online, there is ordinarily a record of everything that goes into it, which there was in this case as well. Like, for example, there was on Alonis's hard drive, there was a conversation he had observed between a supervisor and a coworker talking about how worried they were about him. And I think that when there's evidence like that in the record, any you as attorney will be able to make a mens rea argument just like they would in any other case involving specific intent, just like, possession with intent to distribute of controlled substances. You have to infer their mental state, which you can do from, quantity of drugs. You can also infer it from their conduct. One of my favorite things is when drug dealers think they're being sly by speaking in code, when anybody who listens to more than about 30 seconds of the conversation knows perfectly well what they're doing, and the fact that they're speaking in code is only further indication of their guilty minds. So I think that people in the run of cases won't have much trouble proving up many of these cases. I think that it's right that there will be additional obstacles in some cases, but I suspect that many of those will be at the margin. There was a case in Texas, for example. I mean, one of the reasons I argued against the recklessness standard at the oral argument was that many of the speakers are not experienced speakers and are frankly kind of dumb, and a recklessness standard would potentially sweep them in. The example that I gave, or at least I intended to give, I might have already given it, was the example of a guy who was a teenager in Texas who was in a video game chat room, and somebody said he was crazy because he liked some feature of a video game that the other person thought was stupid or whatever, and he said, yeah, I'm crazy. I'm going to, go kill a bunch of kindergartners and, eat their still beating hearts or something like that. And I think that both of them probably thought that that was what it was, which was a joke, but it just so happened that there was a Canadian adult woman who was trolling the website for reasons unknown, and she reported him to the Texas cops, and he was wound up being jailed for something like 4 months before some anonymous wealthy person bailed him out. And, whatever you think of the facts of that case, because I won't presume to know what was really going on with that kid, but there is at least one reading of that that is benign. And a recklessness standard, which makes you, basically, you have to be aware of the substantial risk. I think Kent's probably better versed on the standard. Kent or Bill Otis are better versed than I than on the standard for recklessness, that you just have to be aware of a substantial risk that somebody would take it as a threat. And I think that there are plenty of stupid teens and 20-somethings who might be caught up by that. Although I should say, as a 48-year-old, that's no skin off my nose if they are. And with that, I'll turn it back over to the rest.
Do we have another question, or do we have a...
We do not have any more questions on the line. Again, if you have a question, please press star and then pound. We don't have Bill Otis on the line anymore either, so, Ken, I think it falls to you
if you want to elaborate on
the recklessness standard.
John's initial point, which is I agree that it, as disappointing as it is to have an opinion of the court which is narrow, it's still better to have an opinion of the court, the official opinion that we know that's the one, as opposed to having a slew of less than majority opinions that you have to pick your way through and try and figure out what the law is. And that's probably why the court came down the way it did. I imagine that they couldn't put together a majority opinion for a broader point, and so they chose the narrow but definitive opinion of the court rather than the fractured, what the hell does that mean, type that we've seen too many times in the U.S. Supreme Court.
It'll be interesting to see if they have any easier time on the next trip up there, because I guess that they will have the benefit of percolation.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully there'll be a couple opinions on either side that are actually, well thought out, which they aren't always. But that may help move the needle one way or the other. If what we would have had here would have been an unclear train wreck, maybe we will at least have something definitive when a case comes back to address this.
As far as Alonis himself goes, it's my understanding he already did the time, so if the U.S. attorney wants to move forward, it would just be for the purpose of keeping the conviction on his record. So
mm-hmm.
I guess there's a management question as to whether they consider that worth their resources.
Right. Well, that was certainly the case until, sometime in May, I'd say mid-May, where it would be true that they'd only be able to have him go back if they retried him, assuming they didn't find harmless error, because I have to imagine that the U.S. Attorney's Office will argue harmless error. And then if they don't find harmlessness, they would have to go back to retrial. And Ken is right that until at least recently, it would have been just to go back and tag him with the felony. But as those of you who keep an eye on Lehigh Valley newspapers may know, Alonis was arrested in middle May for his girlfriend's mother tried to eject him from the house, and he threw a pot at her, and so he was arrested on assault and remains in jail on that. I imagine that there is a decent chance that he will have his supervised release revoked, and so there would be at least some modest amount of jail time for the revocation, which I imagine they would have, you know, be able to go back for on retrial, which might help prevent the judge's wrath in a retrial if it comes to that.
Well, seeing no more questions, do either of you have a final point you'd like to make before we wrap up the call?
I have one final point, which is will show, as Bill Otis says, what a generous person I am. But Kent said, you know, his brief did address recklessness, and it's true, his brief did address recklessness. The court on the whole makes a point of not addressing arguments that are only raised by amici. And I believe that the only exception that I'm aware of involves Kent, because if I'm not mistaken, he was the guy who raised the argument that became Teague versus Lane. So as long as we're both on the line, Kent, is that you?
Yes, that's me. Thank you. That is generous. So that's not the only exception.
Mm-hmm. But the only one that I remember. If there are other ones, you can let me know, and I'll put them in my iPhone so that I don't have to just quote you.
I would also say that the standard of criminal recklessness is a fairly high standard, and I would not regard it as a major threat to freedom of speech.
Well, on behalf of the Federal Society, I want to thank both John Elwood and Kent Scheidegger for carving some time out of their busy schedules on very short notice to offer their analysis of this opinion. Thank you also to our audience. Please do check our website on Monday to see what calls we have lined up for next week. We will have, I think, at least four, possibly even five. Additionally, we'll distribute a notice of those calls as they are scheduled. But until next time, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this practice group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.